extremely extroverted. He was, after all, the star of his own reality TV show. He also demonstrates many of the worst qualities we see in a narcissist. He brags, "I'll be the best jobs president God ever created." He boasts, "It's in my blood. I'm smart," he assured a crowd at a South Carolina rally. Really smart. And he freely insults people, mocking their looks. Rosie O'Donnell is a fat pig. Their talent, Meryl Streep is one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood. And, perhaps because they mattered most to him as a TV star, their ratings. He sparked a Twitter feud with Arnold Schwarzenegger, accusing him of killing Trump's beloved show, The Celebrity Apprentice. Wow, the ratings are in and Arnold Schwarzenegger got swamped, or destroyed, by comparison to the ratings machine DJT. So much for being a movie star. And that was season 1 compared to season 14. Now compare him to my season 1. Donald J. Trump. Tweet from January 6th, 2017. But perhaps the most startling display of Trump's numbers obsession took place when he had his press secretary, Sean Spicer, hold a briefing, the principal subject of which was the size of his inauguration crowd. Many watched and listened in disbelief while reporters pressed the question, why is this topic the central point of the administration's first press briefing? A preoccupation with size is certainly laughably Freudian, but is it reason enough to question Trump's leadership capacity? When does the double-edged sword of narcissism, Trump's or any other president's, turn dangerous? That answer is more complicated than it seems, but it turns in part on whether or not their narcissism is high enough to count as an illness. Pathological narcissism begins when people become so addicted to feeling special that, just like with any drug, they'll do anything to get their high, including lie, steal, cheat, betray, and even hurt those closest to them. Imagine this starting around 9 on the spectrum and getting worse as we approach 10. At these points, you're in the realm of narcissistic personality disorder, NPD. For a detailed description of NPD, see the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-5. But for now, here's a simple explanation. People with NPD have a strong need, in every area of their life, to be treated as if they're special. To those with NPD, other people are simply mirrors, useful only insofar as they reflect back the special view of themselves they so desperately long to see. If that means making others look bad by comparison, say, by ruining their reputation at work, so be it. Because life is a constant competition, they're also usually riddled with envy over what other people seem to have. And they'll let you know it. At the heart of pathological narcissism, or NPD, is what I call Triple E. Entitlement. Acting as if the world and other people owe them and should bend to their will. Exploitation. Using the people around them to make themselves feel special, no matter what the emotional or even physical cost to others. Battering away at their self-esteem or running them into the ground with late-night work projects. Empathy impairment. Neglecting and ignoring the needs and feelings of others, even of those closest to them, because their own need to feel special is all that matters. Exploitation and entitlement, or EE in the research, are linked to just about every troubling behavior pathological narcissists demonstrate. Aggression when their ego is threatened, infidelity, vindictiveness, extreme envy, boasting, name-dropping, denial of any problems or wrongdoing, even workplace sabotage. As people become more addicted to feeling special, they grow ever more dangerous. Here's where pathological narcissism often blends with psychopathy, a pattern of remorseless lies and manipulation. Psychopaths may carry on affairs, embezzle funds, ruin your reputation, and still greet you with a smile, without feeling any guilt, shame, or sadness. Unlike NPD, psychopathy is marked not by impaired or blocked empathy, but a complete absence of it, apart from being able to parrot words that sound like empathy, known as cognitive empathy. In fact, some neuroimaging evidence suggests that psychopaths don't experience emotions the same way non-psychopaths do. The emotion centers of their brains simply fail to light up when they confess shameful events, say, cheating on a spouse or punching a friend, or when they see pictures of people in pain or suffering or anguish. When NPD and psychopathy combine, they form a pattern of behavior called malignant narcissism. This isn't a diagnosis, but a term coined by psychoanalyst Erich Fromm and elaborated on by personality disorder expert Otto Kernberg to describe people so driven by feeling special that they essentially see other people as pawns in their game of kill or be killed, whether metaphorically or literally. Hitler, who murdered millions, Kim Jong-un, who's suspected of ordering his uncle's and brother-in-law's deaths, and Vladimir Putin, who jokes about liquidating journalists, no doubt all fall in the category of malignant narcissist, among possessing other pernicious traits, like sadism or delight in hurting others. The problem is, not all malignant narcissists are as overtly dangerous as people like Hitler, Putin, or Kim Jong-un, especially in democracies like the U.S., where it's still presumably illegal to kill people who disagree with you, even if they do write articles you don't like. That means if we're trying to determine whether or not a pathologically narcissistic president poses a threat to our country or the world, we'll also have to look to subtler indicators than a penchant for murder. We need to examine whether or not they can perform their jobs, one of the most important of which is to preserve the safety of our country and the world. Mentally ill leaders. Are they functional or impaired? The diagnosis of a mental illness, NPD or any other, is not by itself a judgment about whether a person is a capable leader. Steve Jobs, by all accounts, had NPD, yelling at staff, questioning their competence, calling them shit. But he also galvanized Apple's engineers into developing the iMac, the iPod, and the iPhone. No doubt more than a few shareholders would have objected to Jobs's re-removal. He'd already been ousted for his nasty attitude once from the company. He may have had what mental health clinicians call high-functioning NPD. He was narcissistic enough to show triple E, but still able to be incredibly productive, maintain decent enough family relationships and friendships, and mostly keep his angry explosions from completely blowing up the workplace. What mental health experts concern themselves with most when it comes to assessing the dangers of mental illness are functional impairments. That is, how much do the symptoms of a person's mental illness interfere with their ability to hold down a job, maintain meaningful relationships, and, most importantly, manage their intense feelings, such as anger or sadness or fear, without becoming a danger to themselves or others? This is particularly important when it comes to positions as powerful as President of the United States. Steve Jobs calling another CEO a piece of shit has far less troubling implications than the leader of the free world telling a volatile dictator he's very dumb. In other words, in tackling the question of whether or not a leader's narcissism is dangerous, it's not enough to say they're mentally ill. I've helped many clients over the years with active psychotic illness who have wonderful, loving relationships and maintain steady jobs, even while anxiously worrying, for example, about devices being implanted in their teeth. Equating mental illness with incapacity merely stigmatizes the mentally ill. When it comes to the question of whether or not someone who's mentally ill can function, danger is the key to self or others. This is where pathological narcissism and politics can indeed become a toxic, even lethal mix. When peace at home and abroad are at stake, not just the feelings of coworkers, friends, or partners, pathological narcissism unchecked could lead to World War III. The greatest danger, as we saw with Nixon, is that pathological narcissists can lose touch with reality in subtle ways that become extremely dangerous over time. When they can't let go of their need to be admired or recognized, they have to bend or invent a reality in which they remain special despite all messages to the contrary. In point of fact, they become dangerously psychotic. It's just not always obvious until it's too late. Just like narcissism and most traits or conditions, psychosis lies on a spectrum. On the low end, people become thought disordered. That is, use tortured logic, deny embarrassing facts, and show horrendous judgment. On the upper end, they may have auditory and visual hallucinations and paranoid delusions. As their special status becomes threatened, people with NPD bend the truth to fit their story of who they are. If reality suggests they're not special, but flawed, fragile, and, even worse, mediocre, then they simply ignore or distort reality. Did Nixon's psychotic deterioration, for example, lead to more carnage in Vietnam? One biographer claims he bombed the country at least once to impress his friends, and that Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, kept Nixon's rashest decisions in check, making sure any escalation of conflict cleared a committee of military experts. Did Nixon foment more unrest internally than the U.S. would have seen otherwise? Certainly his "the press is the enemy" mantra, which dated back to his anger over the slush fund scandal, pitted the administration against the people. Paranoia is easy to catch when the POTUS suffers from it. Everyone starts looking over their shoulders for danger when the free world's leader says it surrounds us. Turmoil, rage, and distrust swirled through the 1970s. Are we living through that again? Did Nixon make decisions of state while drunk, drowning the pain of his persecution, imagined or real? Given the widespread reports of how much he drank, it's hard to imagine he didn't. Multiple biographers report his staff scrambling to contain his threatened actions, including IRS audits, against the people on his burgeoning enemies list. Did Nixon ever draw counsel from the paintings he spoke to? Did he follow it? These all constitute dangerous functional impairments for a leader. They're the foreign and domestic policy equivalent of leaping from a building, believing you can fly. And they're all part of the psychotic spiral that afflicts pathological narcissists confronted with the troubling truth that they're not as special as they think they are. The psychotic spiral. If we wish to preserve the safety of our country and the world, we have to remain vigilant to the signs of the psychotic spiral in pathologically narcissistic leaders. Increasing paranoia. Increasing paranoia. Pathological narcissists abhor admitting to vulnerability, feeling scared, insecure, unsure of themselves, because they don't trust people to support them when they're upset, a problem called insecure attachment in the research. They don't even like people knowing they're upset, except over feeling attacked. So they divide the world into good and bad, friend and enemy, in simple black and white terms. The advantage being that if they want to feel safe again, if they want to feel assured of their special status. All they need do is flee or eliminate their enemies and cozy up to their friends. In other words, pathological narcissists in a psychotic spiral project, imagining the danger they feel inside themselves, anxiety, panic, confusion, doubts, is coming from outside so that they can escape or destroy it. Unfortunately, because the sense of danger is internal, their insecurity, they have to step up their efforts to attack their enemies in order to feel safe. Imagine this on a global scale, where enemies are communists, or Muslims, or immigrants, or any kind. Nixon was far happier complaining about communist threats than recognizing his errors and correcting them. How often did that lead to additional violence in Vietnam? Could such splitting, as it's called, lead to unnecessary violence again? Impaired judgment. As pathological narcissists become increasingly thought disordered, their vision becomes clouded. That's because if you see the world not as it is, but as you wish or need it to be in order to preserve the belief you're special, you lose touch with crucial information, brute facts, and harsh realities. On a global scale, that means, as it did with Nixon, that if it feeds your ego, step up military action. The precariousness of the world or careful assessments of the dangers of a military assault don't matter at this point. Displays of power and superiority are soothing when pathological narcissists feel like they're falling apart inside. The resulting chaos can be hard to keep up with, and fruitless in the end, as we saw with Nixon's staff chasing after his drunken calls and egregious rants about the Jews working against him. In a startlingly parallel lapse of judgment, Trump reportedly boasted to the Russian ambassador about the impressiveness of his intelligence assessment, spilling secrets Israel shared, without their permission. Volatile decision-making. The sign of a psychotic spiral is particularly troubling. Impaired judgment naturally leads to reactivity and ill-conceived plans. If all that matters to a pathologically narcissistic leader is any action that preserves their special status, at least in their mind, then reality, circumstance, and facts cease to matter. Which means that what a leader says from day to day, or even hour to hour, may shift based on what feels best, not what's best for the country. Right after his staff and appointees spread the message that Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, who was investigating his campaign's and administration's ties to Russia, for incompetence and on the recommendation of the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the president blithely contradicted the statement. "I'd already decided to fire him," Trump proudly proclaimed, as though what mattered most was proving he could make his own decisions, not the appearance, at least, of neutrality or a separation of powers. Trump went on to call Comey crazy, a nut job, and said that firing him relieved the pressure of the Russia investigation. Whether or not this is a sign of thought disorder, at the very least, it shows a remarkable lack of self-preservation. Trump totally ignored that Nixon, too, fired those investigating him, and with fatal consequence. Gaslighting. Often, people with NPD resort to an insidious strategy called gaslighting, a term drawn from the 1938 play about a man who persuaded his wife she was crazy by, among other means, dimming the gaslights and claiming he'd never touched them. As people with NPD become increasingly psychotic, they're determined to convince others that they're the crazy ones who can't see reality for what it is. Gaslighting reassures pathological narcissists that their own grip on reality remains firm because they can't bear to acknowledge their sanity is slipping away. We might ask if we're seeing this now, as Trump and his closest advisors appear on TV, claiming he didn't make statements that journalists often simply play back, or, if it's a tweet, flash an image, to prove that he did indeed say what he said. Lately, these incidents have become commonplace. Many in the press and public at large now refer to them as alternative facts, alluding to Trump spokesperson Kellyanne Conway's now infamous explanation for why Sean Spicer had berated the press for misreporting Trump's inauguration size. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe, Spicer peevishly told a stunned press corps. This turned out to be patently false, though Conway defended the statement, saying Spicer had simply been providing alternative facts. Those who embrace Trump's reality, where the mainstream media lies and remains the enemy, signify their support with red hats bearing the inscription MAGA, Make America Great Again. Those who believe what the news reports about Trump have donned the symbol of resistance, pink pussy hats, a reference to his now infamous hot mic comments about women. I just grab 'em by the pussy. That the country is currently split, and our shared reality with it, seems without question at this point. Spotting lethal leaders. How to save the world. Currently, it's up to you to decide if the evidence cited points to functional impairments in Trump or any other politician. That's not something mental health professionals in the United States are allowed to do. Not yet. Nevertheless, we have in our midst people already trained to provide functional and risk assessments based entirely on observation. Forensic psychiatrists and psychologists, as well as profilers groomed by the CIA, the FBI, and various law enforcement agencies. They spend their whole lives learning to predict how people behave. We could, if we wish, assemble a panel of politically independent specialists within government to provide these assessments. That means suspending the Goldwater Rule, or at least allowing risk assessment to the country, to the world, to take precedence over the sanctity of current ethics. If pathological narcissists, in their reality-warping efforts to feed their addiction, bring themselves to the precipice of disaster, why should we, as nations, allow them to pull us into the abyss with them? It's this urgent existential question that faces democracies throughout the world today.
Craig Malkin, Ph.D., is author of the internationally acclaimed Rethinking Narcissism, a clinical psychologist and lecturer for Harvard Medical School, with 25 years of experience helping individuals, couples, and families. His insights on relationships and narcissism have appeared in newspapers and magazines such as Time, The New York Times, The Sunday Times, Psychology Today, Women's Health, The Huffington Post, and Happen Magazine. He has also been featured multiple times on NPR, CBS Studio, and the Oprah Winfrey Network Channel, among other stations and shows internationally. Dr. Malkin is president and director of the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based YM Psychotherapy and Consultation, Inc., which provides psychotherapy and couples workshops.
I wrote The Art of the Deal with Donald Trump. His self-sabotage is rooted in his past. Tony Schwartz. Why does President Trump behave in the dangerous and seemingly self-destructive ways he does? 3 decades ago, I spent nearly a year hanging around Trump to write his first book, The Art of the Deal, and got to know him very well. I spent hundreds of hours listening to him, watching him in action, and interviewing him about his life. To me, none of what he has said or done over the past 4 months as president comes as a surprise. The way he has behaved over the past 2 weeks firing FBI Director James B. Comey, undercutting his own aides as they tried to explain the decision, disclosing sensitive information to Russian officials, and railing about it all on Twitter, is also entirely predictable. Early on, I recognized that Trump's sense of self-worth is forever at risk. When he feels aggrieved, he reacts impulsively and defensively, constructing a self-justifying story that doesn't depend on facts and always directs the blame to others. The Trump I first met in 1985 had lived nearly all his life in survival mode. By his own description, his father Fred was relentlessly demanding, difficult, and driven. Here's how I phrased it in The Art of the Deal. My father is a wonderful man, but he is also very much a business guy, and strong and tough as hell. As Trump saw it, his older brother Fred Jr., who became an alcoholic and died at age 42, was overwhelmed by his father. Or as I euphemized it in the book, there were inevitably confrontations between the two of them. In most cases, Freddie came out on the short end. Trump's worldview was profoundly and self-protectively shaped by his father. I was drawn to business very early, and I was never intimidated by my father, the way most people were, is the way I wrote it in the book. I stood up to him, and he respected that. We had a relationship that was almost business-like. To survive, I concluded from our conversations, Trump felt compelled to go to war with the world. It was a binary, zero-sum choice for him. You either dominated, or you submitted. You either created and exploited fear, or you succumbed to it, as he thought his older brother had. This narrow, defensive outlook took hold at a very early age, and it never evolved. When I look at myself in the first grade and I look at myself now, he told a recent biographer, I'm basically the same. His development essentially ended in early childhood. Instead, Trump grew up fighting for his life and taking no prisoners. In countless conversations, he made clear to me that he treated every encounter as a contest he had to win, because the only other option from his perspective was to lose, and that was the equivalent of obliteration. Many of the deals in The Art of the Deal were massive failures, among them the casinos he owned and the launch of a league to rival the National Football League. But Trump had me describe each of them as a huge success. With evident pride, Trump explained to me that he was an assertive, aggressive kid from an early age, and that he had once punched a music teacher in the eye and was nearly expelled from elementary school for his behavior. Like so much about Trump, who knows whether that story is true? What's clear is that he has spent his life seeking to dominate others, whatever that requires and whatever collateral damage it creates along the way. In The Art of the Deal, he speaks with street-fighting relish about competing in the world of New York real estate. They are some of the sharpest, toughest, and most vicious people in the world. I happen to love to go up against these guys, and I love to beat them. I never sensed from Trump any guilt or contrition about anything he'd done, and he certainly never shared any misgivings publicly. From his perspective, he operated in a jungle full of predators who were forever out to get him, and he did what he must to survive. Trump was equally clear with me that he didn't value, nor even necessarily recognize, the qualities that tend to emerge as people grow more secure, such as empathy, generosity, reflectiveness, the capacity to delay gratification, or, above all, a conscience, an inner sense of right and wrong. Trump simply didn't traffic in emotions or interest in others. The life he lived was all transactional, all the time. Having never expanded his emotional, intellectual, or moral universe, he has his story down, and he's sticking to it. A key part of that story is that facts are whatever Trump deems them to be on any given day. When he is challenged, he instinctively doubles down, even when what he has just said is demonstrably false. I saw that countless times, whether it was as trivial as exaggerating the number of floors at Trump Tower, or as consequential as telling me that his casinos were performing well when they were actually going bankrupt. In the same way, Trump would see no contradiction at all in changing his story about why he fired Comey and thereby undermining the statements of his aides, or in any other lie he tells. His aim is never accuracy. It's domination. The Trump I got to know had no deep ideological beliefs, nor any passionate feeling about anything but his immediate self-interest. He derives his sense of significance from conquests and accomplishments. "Can you believe it, Tony?" he would often say at the start of late-night conversations with me, going on to describe some new example of his brilliance. But the reassurance he got from even his biggest achievements was always ephemeral and unreliable, and that appears to include being elected president. Any addiction has a predictable pattern. The addict keeps chasing the high by upping the ante in an increasingly futile attempt to recreate the desired state. On the face of it, Trump has more opportunities now to feel significant and accomplished than almost any other human being on the planet. But that's like saying a heroin addict has his problem licked once he has free and continuous access to the drug. Trump also now has a far bigger and more public stage on which to fail and to feel unworthy. From the very first time I interviewed him in his office in Trump Tower in 1985, the image I had of Trump was that of a black hole. Whatever goes in quickly disappears without a trace. Nothing sustains. It's forever uncertain when someone or something will throw Trump off his precarious perch, when his sense of equilibrium will be threatened, and he'll feel an overwhelming compulsion to restore it. Beneath his bluff exterior, I always sensed a hurt, incredibly vulnerable little boy who just wanted to be loved. What Trump craves most deeply is the adulation he has found so fleeting. This goes a long way toward explaining his need for control and why he simply couldn't abide Comey, who reportedly refused to accede to Trump's demand for loyalty and whose continuing investigation into Russian interference in the election campaign last year threatens to bring down his presidency. Trump's need for unquestioning praise and flattery also helps to explain his hostility to democracy and to a free press, both of which thrive on open dissent. As we have seen countless times during the campaign and since the election, Trump can devolve into survival mode on a moment's notice. Look no further than the thousands of tweets he has written attacking his perceived enemies over the past year. In neurochemical terms, when he feels threatened or thwarted, Trump moves into a fight-or-flight state. His amygdala is triggered, his hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis activates, and his prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that makes us capable of rationality and reflection, shuts down. He reacts rather than reflects, and damn the consequences. This is what makes his access to the nuclear codes so dangerous and frightening. Over the past week, in the face of criticism from nearly every quarter, Trump's distrust has almost palpably mushroomed. No importuning by his advisors stands a chance of constraining him when he is this deeply triggered. The more he feels at the mercy of forces he cannot control, and he is surely feeling that now, the more resentful, desperate, and impulsive he becomes. Even 30 years later, I vividly remember the ominous feeling when Trump got angry about some perceived slight. Everyone around him knew that you were best off keeping your distance at those times, or, if that wasn't possible, that you should resist disagreeing with him in any way. In the hundreds of Trump's phone calls I listened in on with his consent, and the dozens of meetings I attended with him, I can never remember anyone disagreeing with him about anything. The same climate of fear and paranoia appears to have taken root in his White House. The most recent time I spoke to Trump, and the first such occasion in nearly three decades, was July 14, 2016, shortly before The New Yorker published an article by Jane Mayer about my experience writing The Art of the Deal. Trump was just about to win the Republican nomination for president. I was driving in my car when my cell phone rang. It was Trump. He had just gotten off a call with a fact-checker for The New Yorker, and he didn't mince words. "I just want to tell you that I think you're very disloyal," he started in. Then he berated and threatened me for a few minutes. I pushed back, gently but firmly. And then, suddenly, as abruptly as he began the call, he ended it. "Have a nice life," he said, and hung up.
Tony Schwartz is the author of several books, including The Art of the Deal, which he co-authored with Mr. Trump. He also wrote The Power of Full Engagement, Managing Energy, Not Time, with Jim Lehrer, and The Way We're Working Isn't Working, a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. He is also CEO and founder of The Energy Project, a consulting firm that helps individuals and organizations solve intractable problems and add more value in the world by widening their worldview. Trump's trust deficit is the core problem. Gail Sheehy, Ph.D. The narcissism and paranoia are issues, but the biggest concern is that Donald Trump trusts no one. This will be his downfall, or maybe ours. In a world spinning radically out of control, can we trust President Trump to rely on his famous instincts as he alienates U.S. allies and plays brinksmanship with our enemies? Writing from the perspective of his first 100 days and from a year and a half of reporting on the president-elect, I can't help worrying how much closer the day of reckoning has to come on charges of collusion with Russia before he needs a war to provide the ultimate distraction. The fundamental bedrock of human development is the formation of a capacity to trust, absorbed by children between birth and 18 months. Donald Trump has boasted of his total lack of trust. "People are too trusting. I'm a very untrusting guy." 1990. "Hire the best people, and you don't trust them." 2007. "The world is a vicious and brutal place. Even your friends are out to get you. They want your job, your money, your wife." 2007. His biographers have recorded his worldview as saturated with a sense of danger and his need to project total toughness. As we know, his father trained him to be a killer, the only alternative to being a loser. Trump has never forgotten the primary lesson he learned from his father and at the military school to which he was sent to be toughened up still further. In Trump's own words, "Man is the most vicious of all animals, and life is a series of battles ending in victory or defeat." In the biography Never Enough, Trump describes to Michael D'Antonio his father's dragging him around tough neighborhoods in Brooklyn when he collected the rents for the apartments he owned. Fred Trump always told the boy to stand to one side of the door. Donald asked why. "Because sometimes they shoot right through the door," his father told him. Today, this man lives mostly alone in the White House, without a wife or any friends in whom to confide, which he would never do anyway, because that would require admitting vulnerability. Leon Panetta, former CIA director and defense chief under Clinton, stated on Fox Business Channel in February 2017, "The coin of the realm for any president is trust. Trust of the American people in the credibility of that president." In the nearly 2 years that Donald Trump has been in our face almost daily, he has sown mistrust in all his Republican rivals, alienated much of the conservative Republican bloc he needs in the House for legislative success, ignored congressional Democrats, and viciously insulted Democratic leaders, calling them liars, clowns, stupid, and incompetent, and condemning Barack Obama as sick and Hillary Clinton as the devil. When he represents the American people abroad, his belligerent behavior and disrespect for leaders of our closest allies rips apart the comity and peacekeeping pledge built over decades. Yet he never hesitates to congratulate despots, such as Turkey's Erdogan, Egypt's General Sisi, and, most lavishly of all, Russia's Putin. As president, Trump is systematically shredding trust in the institutions he now commands. Having discredited the entire 17-agency intelligence community as acting like Nazis, he also dismissed the judiciary because of one judge's Hispanic background and another's opposition to his travel, nay, Muslim ban. Even his Supreme Court Justice, Neil Gorsuch, said it was disheartening and demoralizing to hear Trump disparage the judiciary. Not content to smear the media on a daily basis, Trump borrowed a phrase used by Lenin and Stalin to brand the American media as an enemy of the people. By his own words, Trump operates on the assumption that everyone is out to get him. The non-medical definition of paranoia is the tendency toward excessive or irrational suspiciousness and distrustfulness of others. For a man who proclaims his distrust of everyone, it is not surprising that Trump drew closest to him two legendary conspiracy theorists, Stephen Bannon and General Michael Flynn. And even after he was forced to fire his choice for top national security advisor after Flynn blatantly lied, Trump's White House desperately stonewalled congressional investigators to keep them from getting their hands on documents that could prove Flynn's paid collusion with Russia on Trump's behalf. The closer that case comes to a criminal referral to the Justice Department, the closer Trump's survival instincts will propel him to a wag-the-dog war. A leader who does not trust his subordinates cannot inspire trust. Though Trump boasts of fierce personal loyalty, he himself is loyal only until he isn't. Among his anxious aides, only Jared Kushner, it seems, may be safe, deputized as Trump's de facto Secretary of State. Where Trump succeeds in inspiring trust is by giving his subordinates the license to lie. In fact, this virus of licentiousness has spread from the White House to congressional Republicans, to wit the stunt that exposed Representative Devin Nunes as unfit to lead the House Intelligence Committee probe into Trump operatives' possible collusion with Russia. As the chaos of the White House rolled with a crisis-a-day fever into the month of May, a hide-and-seek commander-in-chief began sending out his most trusted national security advisors to defend him. General James Mad Dog Mattis, General H.R. McMaster, and the muted Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and then cut the legs out from under them with his own blurted half-truths. We hear repeatedly that Trump, as a manager, likes chaos. I asked a deputy White House counsel under Obama, a decorated former officer in Iraq and former White House counsel to President Obama, how such a management style impacts trust. Trump explicitly or implicitly manages the situation so it's never possible for his advisors to know where they stand, he said. It's the opposite of what you want in a high-functioning organization. Trump's anxious aides must know just how easy it is to fail his loyalty test or to be the fall guy if a scapegoat is needed. While publicly they may defend him, it is clear to reporters that White House staffers are leaking information constantly. The leaks can only exacerbate Trump's mistrust, perpetuating a vicious cycle. His failure to trust or to inspire trust is even more dangerous on a global scale. He sees alliances such as NATO as suspect until he changes his mind. He sees trade agreements such as NAFTA as ripping off America until he changes his mind 3 or 4 times in the same week. This is because Trump's worldview is that we live in a snake pit where everybody is out for themselves, observes the former White House counsel. He and his co-conspiracy theorist advisor Bannon take everything that the left behind white working class hates about globalization, and they turn it into personalized enemies, Muslims, Mexicans, and refugees whom they believe are taking away their jobs. Those people aren't like us, is the alt-right message. They're polluting our culture. In the course of his first 100 days, Trump appeared to be increasingly out of touch with the reality in which the majority of us live. His pathological propensity to lie is not the worst of it. His monomaniacal attachment to his lies is, such as the transparent one in his March 4th Twitter storm accusing President Obama of putting a tap on his phone. It raises the question, is this president floating in his own alternate reality? When I attended Dr. Bandy Lee's Yale Town Hall meeting to write about it for the Daily Beast, I cited insights delivered there by two of the authors in this book. Dr. Robert J. Lifton, the eminent former professor of psychiatry at Yale University and today at Columbia University, elaborated in a follow-up interview. Trump creates his own extreme manipulation of reality. He insists that his spokesman defend his false reality as normal. He then expects the rest of society to accept it, despite the lack of any evidence. This leads to what Lifton calls malignant normality. In other words, the gradual acceptance by a public inundated with toxic untruths of those untruths until they pass for normal. Dr. James F. Gilligan is a psychiatrist and author who has studied the motivations behind violent behavior over his 25 years of work in the American prison systems. If we psychiatrists who have experience in assessing dangerousness, if we give passive permission to our president to proceed in his delusion, we are shirking our responsibility, Gilligan said. Today, a senior clinical professor of psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine, Gilligan told Dr. Lee's town hall attendees, "I don't say Trump is Hitler or Mussolini, but he's no more normal than Hitler." We don't have to rely on psychiatrists to see that this president is not consistent in his thinking or reliably attached to reality. We have had vastly more exposure to Donald Trump's observable behavior, his writing and speaking, than any psychiatrist would have after listening to him for years. It is therefore up to us, the American public, to call him on it. And some of the most experienced hands in and around the White House are doing so. Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley believes that Donald Trump represents a very different subculture from any commander-in-chief. He represents the New York building business, where you don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing, says Brinkley. In Trump's world, he must win at all costs. It's not about character or public service or looking out for your band of brothers. The president to whom Trump is most often compared is Richard Nixon. John Dean, the famous White House counsel who testified against his fellow conservative Republican, compared Trump to that notably paranoid president. Nixon was too personae. In public and with his top aides, he was trusted. But in private, his deeply paranoid and vengeful dark side came out. Asked for the best example, Dean snapped, "He had zero empathy, just like Trump." Nixon let 22,000 more Americans die in Vietnam after he sabotaged the 1968 Paris peace talks. Plus, who knows how many Cambodians and Laotians and Vietnamese, all to ensure his election. It took 40 years before Nixon's worst crime was revealed, treason. That was when then-presidential candidate Nixon was heard on tape, from recordings ordered by President Johnson, scuttling the Vietnam peace talks to derail the re-election campaign of the Democratic candidate. Nixon sent a message to the South Vietnamese negotiators that they should withdraw from the peace talks and wait for him to be elected, at which point he would give them a much better deal. Sound familiar? 50 years later, Donald Trump's go-between with Russian officials, General Flynn, hinted to Putin's ambassador that Russia could get a much better deal if it didn't retaliate against Obama's sanctions and instead sat tight until Trump was elected. Also, Trump frequently tweeted about his eagerness to lift those sanctions. That is, until his fantasy bromance with Putin looked like it could arouse a federal investigation. Trump's appetite for vengeance is also matched by Nixon's, with his long enemies list. No two modern presidents have had a more serious case of political hemophilia, in the phrase of the latest Nixon biographer, John Farrell, by which he means, once wounded, these men never stop bleeding. To the dismay of even conservative observers, Trump appears totally indifferent to the truth. Time magazine gave Trump an opportunity to clarify his refusal to correct his long string of falsehoods. What the March 23rd interview produced instead was an astonishing revelation of his thinking. He states what he wants to be true. If his statement is proven false, he is unfazed and confidently predicts that the facts will catch up with his belief. I'm a very instinctual person, but my instinct turns out to be right. Even when the top sleuth in the country, FBI Director James Comey, condemned Trump as a fabulist, Trump ignored the public rebuke and bragged about his ability to persuade millions of his paranoid version of Obama as sick and surreptitiously spying on him. Narcissistic people like Trump want more than anything to love themselves, but desperately want others to love them too, wrote professor and chair of the psychology department at Northwestern University, Dan P. McAdams, in The Atlantic. The fundamental goal in life for a narcissist is to promote the greatness of the self for all to see. Yet, what is an extreme narcissist personality such as Trump to do when he fails to win glorification? Trump, from his own writings, has shown massive hypersensitivity to shame or humiliation, says Dr. Gilligan. Yet, how does he dodge the humiliation when he is exposed as sacrificing the nation's security on the altar of his infantile need to impress Russian officials by giving away sensitive foreign intelligence? Beneath the grandiose behavior of every narcissist lies the pit of fragile self-esteem. What if, deep down, the person whom Trump trusts least is himself? The humiliation of being widely exposed as a loser, unable to bully through the actions he promised during the campaign, could drive him to prove he is, after all, a killer. In only the first 4 months of his presidency, he teed up for starting a war in three places, Syria, Afghanistan, and North Korea. It is up to Congress, backed up by the public, to restrain him. Gail Sheehy, Ph.D., as author, journalist, and popular lecturer, has changed the way millions of women and men around the world look at their life stages. In her 50-year career, she has written 17 books, including her revolutionary Passages, named one of the 10 most influential books of our times. As a literary journalist, she was one of the original contributors to New York Magazine, and since 1984 has written for Vanity Fair. A winner of many awards, 3 honorary doctorates, a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2012 by Books for a Better Life, she has regularly commented on political figures, including in her acclaimed biography of Hillary Clinton, Hillary's Choice.
Sociopathy. Lance Dodes, M.D. Crazy like a fox, or just crazy? This question has surrounded Donald Trump since his campaign for president. The question is whether a person who is repetitively immoral, who cons others, lies, cheats, and manipulates to get what he wants, doesn't care whom he hurts, just as long as he is gratifying himself, whether such a person's indifference to the feelings of others for personal gain is just being clever, crazy like a fox. Or are these actions a sign of something much more serious? Could they be expressions of significant mental derangement? The answer to that question is emphatically yes. To understand why, it's necessary to understand the psychological condition called sociopathy and why sociopathy is such a severe disturbance. Caring for others and trying not to harm them is a fundamental quality of not just humans, but many mammals. Normal people, as well as normal wolves, dolphins, and elephants, appreciate when another of their species is in pain or danger, and, unless fighting over territory or sexual partners, react to protect one another. Such caring and cooperation has major survival value for any species, and its clear evolutionary advantages have made these qualities basic across much of the animal kingdom. In humans, the ability to sense the feelings of one another, care about one another, and try to avoid harming one another, even to the extent of placing ourselves at a disadvantage, think of animals that will stand all together to protect against a threat, is called empathy. It is a characteristic of all people, no matter what individual emotional conflicts and issues they have, unless they are sociopaths. The failure of normal empathy is central to sociopathy, which is marked by an absence of guilt, intentional manipulation, and controlling or even sadistically harming others for personal power or gratification. People with sociopathic traits have a flaw in the basic nature of human beings. Far from being clever like a fox, they are lacking an essential part of being human. This is why sociopathy is among the most severe mental disturbances. Yet, we are a culture that admires external success in wealth and power, regardless of how it is achieved. People with sociopathic qualities who are able to achieve high status and power, precisely because of their manipulations and cheating, are, therefore, sometimes seen as not only psychologically healthy, but superior. This contributes to the confusion, how crazy can someone be who is so successful? It has even been said that Mr. Trump couldn't possibly have serious mental problems because he got to be president. Indeed, there are generally two life paths for people with severe sociopathy. Those who are unskilled at manipulating and hurting others, who are not careful in choosing their victims, who are unable to act charming well enough to fool people, have lives that often end in failure. They are identified as criminals or lose civil court battles to those they've cheated, or are unable to threaten their way back to positions of power. But those who are good at manipulation, at appearing charming and caring, at concealing their immoral or illegal behavior, and can bully their way to the top, do not end up as outcasts or in prison. There is a term for these people, successful sociopaths. They are the ones who most fool others into thinking they are crazy like a fox. Even their characteristic rages may appear almost normal. Instead of having a visible tantrum, they may simply fire people or sue them. As their power increases, their ability to disguise their mental disturbance may also increase, concealed behind a wall of underlings who do the dirty work, or armies of lawyers who threaten those who are currently seen as the enemy. What is important to understand is that their success is on the outside. They are no different from those who are less skilled at concealing their lack of empathy, even if they require an expert to recognize them. They are still severely emotionally ill. Diagnostic labels. The word sociopathy is sometimes used interchangeably with psychopathy, though some have defined the words a bit differently. Sociopathy is also a major aspect of the term malignant narcissism and is roughly synonymous with the official Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, psychiatric diagnostic term antisocial personality disorder. All refer to a disturbance in an individual's entire emotional makeup, hence the term personality disorder in the DSM. A label can never capture everything about a person, though. This may create diagnostic confusion if laypersons expect any individual to fit exactly into their conception of the problem. Cold-blooded murderers and cruel sadistic rulers may treat their pets kindly, for instance. Consequently, it is the traits of sociopathy that are important to recognize in order to evaluate anyone or assess his fitness to hold a position of power. This is, in fact, the way the DSM does it. Each label has a set of observable behaviors that define it, and these groupings change often. We are now on the fifth version of the DSM, and there will be many more to come as knowledge, understanding, and even diagnostic fads change. Traits, however, are fixed. Therefore, in assessing whether a person is sociopathic, what we really need to know is whether he has the observable definitive traits that indicate the condition. Without being concerned about a formal diagnostic label, it's useful to consider the traits of antisocial personality disorder as defined in the current DSM. A pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others occurring since age 15 years, as indicated by three or more of the following. 1. Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors. 2. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeated lying or conning others for personal profit or pleasure. 3. Impulsivity or failure to plan ahead. 4. Irritability and aggressiveness, as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults. 5. Reckless disregard for safety of self or others. 6. Consistent irresponsibility, as indicated by repeated failure to